acquiring a customer, as we know, is a lot more costly than keeping a customer. So if you spend all your money acquiring a bunch of price-sensitive customers, that's not going to be loyal to you, that's going to jump ship as soon as they can, you sort of lost out, because then you spent all that money on acquiring them, and maybe you don't have enough money to keep the customers you have engaged and so forth.
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
So today I am honored to have none other than Per Sjöfors. Now, have I pronounced that correctly?
Pretty good, yes, pretty good.
I've been practicing for days, I can tell you, and it's pretty tricky, actually.
Yeah.
You get this all the time, I'm sure, but is there the correct pronunciation? Is it slightly different?
Well, if you would do it in Swedish, it would be Sjöfors.
And there is no clue with the letters there. The letters and the pronunciation are entirely discombobulated.
Well, because it's a different language.
A bit like pricing. To many people, pricing is an entirely different language, a language that they need someone to help them understand.
Yeah, and that's what we do. Pricing, it's very interesting, I think, because pricing means so much for the bottom line of companies and particularly startups. And yet it's one of these, it's supposed to be one of the four P's of marketing, and yet it's the sort of forgotten P in many cases. So that's we've been doing this now for several years, and it's been a really fun journey to say.
Let me take a minute to tell everyone a little bit about you and the company that you run and what you guys do, which is, you know, it's pretty interesting, to put it mildly. And so you're the CEO and founder of Attenga, and you're also the co-founder and CEO of Sales for Profit. You're an acknowledged expert in pricing and pricing psychology. You've had over 500 assignments with some pretty large companies. And the reason they want you is by fixing the pricing. In many cases, you've helped CEOs and investors double the company's growth rates, double or triple their profitability. And I really want to explore that. So because of this, you've been quoted in the press like Fortune Magazine and Inc. Magazine and Industry Week and Financial Times, and you regularly keynote at conferences. So, you know, this is a probably very little understood sector, but it is incredibly important that companies understand pricing.
Yeah. In my experience, what happened is that companies either believe that pricing is a black art, or they believe pricing right is so complicated that it's sort of not worth their while, and that is actually not so. And because they either think it's black art or too complicated, they end up guessing, or they end up using a fixed margin. The board says we are going to have margin goals of X, and the company then goes out and say, well, that's how we're going to price. What the company's margin goals or what end up being often guesses or guesswork, gut feel, or maybe pegging your price to a competitor, has nothing to do with the value you deliver to a client. And it's pricing according to that value that is the whole key of pricing right.
And there are some figures here. So something like 80% of companies get their pricing wrong. Are those the figures that I remember you mentioned last time we spoke?
Yeah. There's actually, so that we did a project on ourselves, to be honest, and we figured the research project, and we found that 4% of American CEOs believe pricing is important.
Okay, so let's get some real life examples. So let's talk about how businesses, and there's a huge percentage of startups that fail. So let's talk about an example. So I've got a startup company. I want to deliver a service. And that service could be a piece of software, for example. So typically what happens is I'm going to go online. I'm going to do 10 minutes of research and figure out who my competitors are. And I'm going to say, well, they're pricing at this much, so I'm going to price the same. Is that what happens?
That is what happened many, many times. And there's a couple of things. First of all, the likelihood that the competitor that you peg yourself to has priced themselves right is pretty small. So if they have the wrong price, you're going to end up with the wrong price. And also what happens in addition to that is if you peg yourself to a competitor, you allow yourself to be commoditized. And obviously, if you're commoditized, you have lost your pricing power. It is to differentiate your service in such a way that is meaningful to your customers, that allows you pricing power, that allows you to price higher and to make more, to have a higher profit margin. So, and it's that whole dynamic of understanding who are the customers that is the most attractive for you, who are the customers that has the highest willingness to pay, and what exactly are they willing to pay extra for that is different than the other guy.
Okay, so I agree with you, because all the research that I've done indicates that most people don't realize how important pricing is. They get it wrong, and so because of that, they're losing out huge amounts of potential margin, because what they're doing is they're saying, this is what it costs us to make the product. We're going to add a little bit of margin on top, when in fact, it should be completely the other way around. So let's talk about IKEA. So IKEA have got their pricing right. I think, you know, everyone understands that. How do they do their pricing?
Well, they it's interesting that you mentioned that. They start with when they develop a product, when they have an idea for a new product, they start with a price, and then they do their analysis whether they can actually design and build and ship that product and still meet that price. And if in fact they can't, the product will not be built. So they start with price and go, you know, forward from there. Whereas in the vast majority of companies, it's the other way around. And one of the reasons I got into what I do is that I've been through too many of these very, very stormy pricing meetings. Where you have, you know, product management, you have finance, you have marketing, you have sales, and it's an ad hoc meeting because suddenly you have to put a price list out on the web, or suddenly you have to go to a trade show and you have to be able to tell prices to your salespeople, and it's always very passionate because people have always very strong opinions about prices. And the only typical, in those cases, the only actual data that one may have is the cost.
Yeah.
And eventually somebody, normally the most senior people or person in the room, just, you know, slams his fit on the table or her fit and say, this is the price.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the value they deliver. It has nothing to do with what people are actually willing to pay, and the chances that price is going to be right is almost zero.
Let's talk about Williams-Sonoma. There's a very well-documented case study of a bread machine that Williams-Sonoma wanted to bring out a few years ago, not too long ago. So, you know the story very well. I mean, is that something you can...
This story is that they brought out this bread machine and it didn't sell. It sold far less than they expected. And what they did at that point was that they simply increased the price.
Yeah.
And the product started to sell. And there is a reason for why this is happening. And I have talked to I don't know how many people that have similar experiences, whether it's consumer goods or business to business goods, or whether it's products or services. They suffer sales volume that is far less than they thought they would have.
Yes,
and they increase the price and suddenly sales don't.
But I think with Williams-Sonoma, what it was they launched a bread maker at $270 or something. You're absolutely right. Sales didn't happen. So they then increased another model. And I think that's the key, okay. Which had like 10% more features, a couple of chrome knobs or something.
Yeah.
But they put the price up to $415. So suddenly people saw the $275 model as maintaining amazing value, because hey, what's the difference? This thing is like almost twice the price, but it's got, I can't see what the difference is. So
there's psychology about pricing. First off, if you price yourself too low, people will believe that the benefit that you promise is not going to happen. One of the things that I have done through the years is I asked thousands of people whether they would buy gas if somebody offered that gas to 10 cents a gallon. And so far, nobody said yes.
Yeah.
What they say is, maybe it's damaged my car and I don't want to take that risk.
Yeah.
Maybe it's full of water, maybe. So price is actually the most powerful message of quality there is.
Yeah.
And if you have a quality product, you need to price it high. Specifically to the Williams-Sonoma case, I can tell you another very interesting case. Similar, this was a company that they sold electric drills, and they had three different models. And this was they had priced themselves completely based on cost, and the models ended up being I think it was $90, $95, and $120. And the psychology, so when we see prices or when we see numbers as humans, we always compare. We cannot not compare. So in this case with the drills, what happened was that the cheapest one at $90, and then you had one at $95. So yeah. In people's mind, they said, oh, these two must be almost the same. So let me save $5 and buy the cheapest, okay?
Yeah.
And then the jump to the premium model at 120 was, you know, it was fairly substantial. So there was only a few people who then could afford to buy the best, okay? So to solve this problem, the middle one that was priced at 95 was increased to 107. And there's a particular way of measuring this called cross price elasticity that is very technical, and I won't go into that. But at 107, the way people compared these prices was that the one at 90 compared to the 107 suddenly felt that it was too cheap. So therefore, it couldn't be any good. But then the jump from 107 to the 120 was so little, so you know, much smaller. So there was a lot of people that said, "Ah, I can afford the best one." And the result of all of this was that the one at 90 used to be the top seller. What happened was that the middle one, the one that was now 107, became the top seller. Okay.
Yeah.
with a much higher margin, and also sales of the most expensive one doubled.
Because they were from, they were zero, almost zero.
Yeah, they were, yeah, it wasn't zero, but we, you know, among those three models, maybe the top one, I think it accounted for about 8 or 10%, and that went up to 20. And this, the lowest selling model out of these three became the $90 one.
Yeah.
So the psychology of pricing is so important. And going back to the Williams-Sonoma case, that's something that's called price imaging.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you a story of the most effective price imaging I have ever seen. And that is from this company that we know is do pricing superbly, and that's Apple.
Yeah.
Okay. So when they brought out the Apple Watch, was that a year and a half ago? 2.5 years ago?
Well, yeah, seems that way. Yes.
Yeah. They also brought out a $10,000 version and a $17,000 version, which it's the same watch. It's just that it's gold, or maybe even just gold plated.
Yes.
So the same innards and everything. But what happened was that this attracted so many journalists, you know, about the outrageous price of 17,000 versus the 349 of the regular watch, that in all the write-ups about this watch, the launch for the watch, it was the 17,000 outrageous price and the $349 actual price you're going to pay.
Yes.
And what happened is that every time somebody would add that $349 got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
It seems cheap. It's like they're almost giving it away because of the...
That's right. That's right. And I don't know if anybody actually ever bought this $17,000 one. I'm sure a few people did. But that was not the point.
And you see this at TJ Maxx.
You see it everywhere.
These discount stores where you see the ticket sort of should be selling at $170, marked down to $75 or something. But
that's another interesting thing, because I said that the price is the most important value message, okay? And you get this, you make your assessment on whether this is actual value or not based on the price, okay? So if you have a price of whatever, $149, okay, and you then have a discount, you actually make your decision based on quality decision on the price.
Yeah.
Then the discount makes it an even better deal. So a price plus a discount is different than a low price. You see how that works?
Absolutely. So because what you're doing is you're establishing that this product or service that I'm selling actually should be worth $1,000.
That's right.
Because of certain circumstances, whether it be the time or any other, it's a sale or something like that, you had the opportunity to get this high-value product at a low price. So be quick about it, that sort of
thing. That's right. Now there is, this works to a point. If you discount too much, it obviously becomes a message of the same, poor quality. They couldn't sell it. They're giving it away, you know. And in fact, in retail, if you have the store brands compared to the regular brands, if a store brand is priced less than 15% lower than the actual brand, then sales start to taper off.
Because they perceive the quality is lower.
That's right.
Yes. So what questions do you ask? So let's say I'm launching a product. Let's say it's a service, for example, and I have no idea where to pitch the pricing. People saying, well, you should do it about $200 or something because that's what everyone else is doing. What questions would you ask on my behalf? So let's say I took on your company and said, look, I want you to help me come up with a price. Mm-hmm. How would you do that?
Well, you do it in research, and you do research into your customer population, whether that's a business population or whether it's a consumer population. And first off, you establish what is different between your service and everybody else's, okay? And that may be,
It could be anything.
I saw this van down on, I think it was Venice Boulevard, like a couple of months ago, pink van with big text on it said that they were doing topless cleaning services.
Well, there you are. Perfect. Yes. Yeah. So I don't see the benefit, but
No, neither do I. But obviously they had figured out something that is different, you know? Yes. So you have to figure out what is different with your service versus anybody else's, okay? And then you measure what people are willing to pay for that difference compared to all your competitors.
Yeah.
And in fact, going back to these differentiators, that's something. I'm missing a name here. Warren Buffett.
Yes.
Said at one point that if you have pricing power, that's his highest criterion for investing in a company, whether a company has pricing power and can increase prices without losing sales. And you do that by differentiate yourself. And so you measure, you establish what's different between you and competitors. You ask a series of questions unaided to figure out what what people are willing to pay for that. And specifically, you ask what price people believe it is so low that they start doubting the quality.
Yeah.
You ask whether what price is just so high is out of the question. You ask what price would be obtainable with a stretch.
Yeah.
And what price would be, low, but not so low you don't doubt the quality.
So you're sort of creating the edges.
You create the box. Yeah.
Quality.
And when you ask these questions over a customer population that gives you statistical significance, it really works every time. There will always be outliers, and you remove them from the data. But then the next step, which is the really crucial step, is to segment that pricing data, this willingness to pay data, based on, it could be demographics, it could be sociographics, and on those differentiators between your service and your competitor's service.
And is this research I should do myself, or is it better to get a...
No, you need a specific... We've developed a proprietary statistical method to ensure that this data that you capture is actually valid. So,
and why do all the prices always end in a 9?
Oh, they don't actually.
Is 7 the new 9?
Yeah, 7 is the new 9. There is first off, if you do end up on a 9. There is solid data out there saying that, say, since we've been on 150 versus 149, you will sell approximately 20% more at 149.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that you're going to necessarily sell more of that particular product, but the customer spend is going to be higher.
Yeah.
So it may be that they buy this gadget for 150 and they buy the gadget,
Yeah.
But at 149, they may buy the gadget and then options and you know, so forth. So it's the customer spend that increases. And the second is that these, we call them price walls. Price walls are pricing psychological pricing points.
Yeah.
Where small price changes makes for a very big difference in sales volume. And in some cases, you may lose, if you go over one of these walls, you may lose 50 or 60% of your sales. But also the flip side, of course, is true, meaning that if you cross that that price wall down, yeah, your sales may increase double or three times.
Yes.
And this is why we're saying that when you price right, not only do you sell more, but you also make more.
Exactly. So what you're saying is just by understanding the psychology and by looking at qualitative and quantitative research,
yeah,
change the price. You can, and I'm sure there are many instances where you've increased the price, like the drill I was using earlier, and actually doubled or tripled sales. So that's why it's so counterintuitive.
It is, and it all has to do with this psychology. And I mean, one of the things is this is something that goes out to startups. There's also something else that is very, very important that I think I mentioned the other day, and that is that if you have a disruptive product or service,
yeah,
you will only sell to early adopters.
Yes.
And the problem with early adopters is that there are just very few of them. So, and these early adopters buy for all different reasons, but low price is not one of them. Okay, and the most common mistakes that happen that for these companies to bring out the disruptive product is that they price it ever which way they price it. They probably just guess, as we've been talking about, and then they go out to the market and they sell a few of these, but they only sell a few because there are only few early adopters. And then they look at their projections, they look at their bank balance, and they drop the price.
Yeah.
In most cases, what happens is there will be no increase in sales. Sales may even go down. And then they can't raise the price again. So they die.
Yes.
This is the most common mistake.
And this is real. I mean, because this is... This affects any business, whether it's a disruptive business or a tech business or an online business or a dry cleaners.
Yes. I mean,
what happens is when you open, you get your initial buzz, and that gives you a full sense of security that this price is right. And so what happens is you think, okay, I've sold X number of, you know, dry cleaning coupons or whatever to these people at this price. So if I reduce my price, I'll 10 times turnover.
Yeah,
that's right. What you're saying is that doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't, and I mean, it happens if you have something well established, but in those early days, no, it doesn't.
And psychology. I mean, there's all sorts of psychology. I went to a restaurant the other day where the menu there wasn't a dollar sign on it anywhere, and everything was, you know, the food was 10 or 12 or 20.
Yeah.
So it was like it didn't actually cost anything because it wasn't real money. you know, it was just a number, so there was no dollar sign. So,
well, I mean, in restaurant menus by themselves are sort of interesting because some people make the mistakes in you don't want to line up the prices on the left like so many restaurants do, because the end result is that we tend to... then look at the price first and then make our choice. And so that means that there will be a bias towards buying cheaper goods. Whereas instead, if you have the prices with or without the dollar sign, just by the actual description of the product,
yeah,
then you actually make decisions on what you want to eat, not the price.
Yes,
you know, primarily, of course. I mean, there's a, and there are other things. If you, we talked a little bit about online businesses, and this is also related to this price imaging and the story there about Williamson Sonoma.
Yes.
You look at online businesses or SaaS businesses, they almost always start with the lowest price, and then they have a thing in the middle, and then they have the highest price.
Yeah.
Wrong way around. You should start with a high price, then you should have the middle, and then you should have the low price.
Yes.
That will increase conversion with about 45%.
But you're absolutely right about the perception of quality, because I was looking at BuzzSumo's site the other day, which is a leagues more expensive than most other sites. And the immediate feeling that I got was that this stuff is going to be pretty good, because it's like 5 or 10 times more expensive than some of its competitors.
Uh-huh.
And I'm actually more inclined to use something like BuzzSumo, because I get more confidence that this is actually going to be a proper service, because I'm paying a proper amount.
Yeah, well, it's the same as, you know, I have our website hosted in a place where I pay, I don't know, 10 times what I would pay if I selected the cheapest. But I know I get good service. I know I have... you know, customer service that I can speak to that actually solves problems.
Or maybe you just have the perception of that. It may be that the service is just the same, but just your perception.
Yeah, it's my perception. Yeah.
Yes.
And I, again, I have a personal story on that. This is a couple of years ago. I was in Vegas and I needed to get a haircut. And on the way to the convention center, I passed this sign saying, you know, $9 haircuts, and that's too cheap for me.
Yeah.
I passed another sign saying $12 haircuts, and eventually I had a haircut where there were no signs at all, and I paid the 20 or so bucks that I'm thinking I should pay. And I have no idea whether my haircut was any better or any worse than that $9 one, but I didn't want to take the risk.
Yes.
You know. And then, of course, I passed one more sign saying, "We fix $9 haircuts."
Fantastic. Yes. There's a market for everything.
There is, yeah. So, and I think if the audience here, you know, I'm sure that they can look back on any number of occasions where they haven't bought the cheapest. They haven't even considered the cheapest because of this psychology. And then they go back to their company and slash their prices.
But the problem is, let's talk about webinars. So let's say I want to launch a webinar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually afraid that I'm going to overprice this and I'm going to get zero subscribers.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do, I'm going to give it away. I'm going to say, you've got all of this value, but it's, you know, it's free, or it's at a huge discount, because I am so nervous that I don't want to increase the prices. And is that a common
problem? Well, people? It is, but there's also an issue of why do you do the webinars, and what results do you want from the webinars? Because those who attend a free webinar or a free service or a very low cost service are always the people who are not committed to you,
yeah,
to whatever you do. So, okay, so you have 100 people that paid nothing, of which 99 is basically just, they're just filling a share, okay?
Yeah.
Maybe one or maybe two are the people who you actually want to, you know, reach with your message, and they would be most likely willing to pay for it. So what's the point in having 98 people who you don't really want to talk to when you can have two people that you really want to talk to at some cost?
Yeah.
And that's another takeaway from this little discussion piece, and that is that the price-sensitive customers, are always going to be the customers who are less loyal to you. Because as soon as there is some alternative, they will jump ship and go to that cheaper alternative. Why is this important? Well, it's important because acquiring a customer, as we know, is a lot more costly than keeping a customer. So if you spend all your money acquiring a bunch of price-sensitive customers, that's not going to be loyal to you, that's going to jump ship as soon as they can, you sort of lost out, because then you spent all that money on acquiring them, and maybe you don't have enough money to keep the customers you have engaged and so forth.
But do you have a real struggle, coming back to your CEO thumping the table example, people that don't understand pricing, that are afraid that if we increase our prices, we're just going to lose all our customers?
I'm sorry, was that a question?
Yes. Do you come across CEOs in companies where you think they would know better, but they're so afraid of losing customers?
Yeah, in fact, a majority of our clients, they come to us and they say, I've held my prices now for 8 years or 6 years or whatever it is, and I'm scared shitless to increase them.
Yes.
And that's, I can give you another example. A company, they're in the space of they're selling, ceiling speakers and stuff like that for home theater. Or whole house audio, and they sell through, they don't sell directly to consumers, they only sell to installers.
Yeah.
These products, they're made in China. They had held prices for too long, and they were really up against the wall. So we engaged with the company. We did exactly what I mentioned. We went out to their customers, these installers. We measured what they're willing to pay for these products. We measured what they specifically are willing to pay more for, and we could advise the companies where to put prices. And prices could increase substantially, so substantially that you didn't want to do it in one go.
Yeah.
What happened was that the CEO of the company, he said, if I increase prices, I'm going to lose all my business.
Yep.
They increased prices with roughly 10%. And he called me and he said, I didn't hear anything. Yes. Nobody said anything.
What happened to their numbers? What happened to their bottom line?
And then they increased prices the next, after 6 months.
Yeah.
Same thing. And after 6 months, same thing. And the end result of all of this is that when we engaged with the company, they had a blended margin of about 42%.
Yeah.
And at the end of the engagement, they had a blended margin of 56.
Which is a 20 something percent increase.
Yeah, exactly. And those results are typical.
Which is astonishing. And also the two companies that you run. So you have a Tenga, which is dealing with the huge organizations, and you set up sales for profit. So how would, if I'm a company looking to understand how to fix my pricing, how would I take you on? How would I contact you, or what's the process?
Well, Atenga is, like you said, we are doing these very in-depth, very complex projects that deals primarily with larger companies. And it's not for startup, basically.
Sure.
For startups, sales for profit, we take the methodology that we use in Atenga and systemize it, so we can do it a lot cheaper and a lot quicker.
And how do people get hold of you?
Because salesforprofit.com.
Okay.
So it's sales4profit.com. And you can, in fact, we set it up so you can buy one of these price measures using your credit card.
Fantastic.
So, and that means that you also can stretch the payment, which is good for a startup. And we priced ourselves so that our services, so that it should be less than a month's salary for an employee.
Which is great, because then at least as a startup or as a company that's beginning to find its way in this marketplace, just that one decision could double or triple your margins, which is the difference between success and failure, really.
I have another story.
No, please.
So there was this company, name escaped me. It was published in the Wall Street Journal like 3 or 4 years ago. They had interviewed 104 ex-CEOs of ex-startups. And they asked them, what was the reason you failed? And what they said was that 20% was pricing errors. Okay? That's pretty big by itself.
Yes.
Then they said another 60% pricing was a contributing factor.
Wow.
Okay? And the balance, 20%, was the wrong team.
Yes.
So getting pricing right is really crucial. So as an investor in a company, and obviously the founders are also investors, this is an insurance policy.
And it's something that probably most companies don't understand is available. They don't understand your technology, your experience, your statistical, qualitative and quantitative analysis is available. And it is actually a science, and it's not finger in the air guesswork.
No, I got into this because in the companies I ran in Europe and here in the US, we did experiments with pricing.
Yes.
And some of those experiments worked beautifully and others were complete disasters.
Yes.
And what I had learned about pricing in business school and what I could read about pricing was just too academic. It was nothing that we could use. So I figured out the method that actually have been, it's been working every time, ever since. The cornerstone of that method is measuring willingness to pay and correlate value drivers and decision drivers with willingness to pay.
And the great thing is that you're the architect, so you can explain very simply how this works. And as we've seen from some of these examples, it can make such a massive difference. And most importantly, I think it's most useful when you're just about to launch a product or a service.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're set up for success then, basically, if people work with you.
We all know that most startups fail. Okay, whether we want to recognize it or not, but that's
not here. No.
And if you get your pricing right, you go from you're almost always going to fail if you don't price right. But if you price right, you're almost always going to succeed.
I think that's fabulous. I mean, that's a key phrase.
It is.
You get your pricing right, you're almost always going to succeed. If you get it wrong, you're almost always going to fail.
Yeah, correct.
That's pretty
cool. And that's why this is so crucial. And people go and say, well, I think this is the price that feels good. Nope. That's not quite.
That's right. As a scientist, you shake your head in disbelief. That's brilliant.
Well,
I can't thank you enough. It's been absolutely fascinating talking.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
And I'm sure that everyone listening to this will have a the most revealing moment and understanding about what pricing is all about. And they'll probably.
I hope so. I hope it's been a little bit enlightening for some people.
Definitely. I think they should be kicking your door down to find out how to fix their business. So, but I'll put all your details. But thank you once again. It's been an absolute pleasure. And
all right.
Look forward to speaking to you soon.
Okay. Bye.